Being a good parent isn't just about having a set of skills or knowing the right thing to do all the time. Ask any good parent you know. They can tell you their pro tips, but most are happy to admit that a lot of parenting feels like winging it. Who we are and how we continue to grow matters because our kids pick up most of what they learn from us by watching how we do things, not by listening to our instructions. So join me on this journey of remodeling our mindsets so that our actions speak to those watching. I'm Dr. Dina Shelton, and this is Remodel Parenting. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Remodel Parenting Podcast, and we are continuing lessons from classic research. Today, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite experiments that I studied when I was an undergrad, and one that is typically a favorite. In fact, I had someone who listens ask me and say, are you going to do the Stanford Prison Experiment? And of course, I am. Now, the disclaimers that I have been giving have applied to many of the research studies that I've covered, that a lot of these were performed before a lot of research ethics were in place that we follow now. And so in discussing these, we're not condoning the methods. And I say this one even more significantly for this study because it's probably one of the most controversial studies in all of these famous psychological studies and in a lot of the ethics discussions about them. Now, this experiment is one that has fascinated me from early on. When I was studying psychology and human behavior, there are elements in this that you're going to probably pick up from other experiments in this series, like Milgram's study on obedience, Elliott's class divided, and Ash's conformity study. However, this is one for the books, and it's very complicated. So I'm going to try and do this as briefly and succinctly as possible without going in or without missing important pieces of information. A lot of what you can pick up from this study is going to be learned by what happened. And so there'll be some application pieces at the end, but as the last few have been, awareness and a shifting in our mentality of what we as people are capable of and what we as people miss and choose when the right elements are in place, change how we do things in the bigger picture, especially with our kids. We all tend to believe that we would stick to our morals and ethics in a situation where we're asked to compromise them. We'd also like to think that we're strong and that we speak up against wrong things and that we have an independent mind and we make our own decisions and act intentionally in what we do. The Stanford Prison Experiment is one of the most controversial studies of all times, and it was the birthplace of many of our ethics that we follow today. And it was such an influential piece that made everyone stop and think about protecting participants and protecting and taking care of people during studies and giving people a lot of freedom and reminders of their voluntary nature in the studies that they're participating in. This study took place in the early 1970s. Philip Zimbardo and his colleagues at Stanford became interested in the reports of guard brutality in American prisons. They wanted to conduct an experiment to determine if the actions were results of personal dispositions, like sadistic tendencies and psychopathy in the people who were hired, or if they were situational, like environmental influences or things that changed people once they were working there. At the time, most people attributed evil and harmful behavior to individual decision and disposition. Zimbardo believed that situation actually had an influence. So they converted the basement of the psychology building at Stanford into a mock prison, and they worked to keep it as realistic as possible. He hired an ex-inmate to consult with him on jail experiences and what prison looked like, felt like, the experience was like, and they developed processes that were not exact mimics of a prison, but that gave the same feel and experience of that. He ran a newspaper ad to recruit volunteers for the study. The ad said that it was a two-week psychological study of prison life, and it promised participants $15 a day. Now, that sounds cheap, but back then, that would be the equivalent to about $100 a day today, and you can imagine that a lot of young people were interested in that amount of money for just taking part in some type of study and experiment. What they wanted, though, was to determine if, quote, normal people would respond and change in a setting that encouraged it. And so, when they had responses, and they had a lot of them, over 70 people reached out saying that they would like to participate in this study. They ultimately selected 24 college students, male college students, to participate in the study. And that was because they wanted to use a group of people who would have been considered at the time as not likely to fall into sadistic type practices or any type of harmful behavior, or who would have their own minds and processes. They used psychological testing and diagnostic interviewing before they allowed the participants to start the study, and they only selected people who were normal on all scales and did not show any type of psychological distress or disorders before the time of the study. The participants, all 24 of them, were randomly assigned, actually by coin tosses. Half of them were assigned as guards and half of them were assigned as prisoners. All of them were briefed that this was going to be a full prison simulation, that half of them would be assigned as prisoners and would go to prison, and the other half would be assigned as guards and would manage the prison. There was no deception in this study. The half that were assigned as prisoners, however, did not realize exactly how realistic it would start. So while there was no deception, the realism of the situation was far more significant than they realized. The local police department, this was done in Southern California, or Central California, but the police department actually went and arrested the young men at their homes and carried them to the local police department to hold them before they were transferred to what they were calling the Stanford County Jail. So from the beginning, they even had the city playing a role with this this experiment and study. And from the start, there was no breaking of character or any situation. They were arrested as though they had committed crimes. When they brought them to Stanford, they had a mock warden who brought them in and processed them into the prison. And he emphasized the seriousness of the participants' offenses as they were being booked. And they had a full process of stripping them down, assigning them a uniform, assigning them an ID number. They were told that they were only allowed to refer to themselves and others by their ID numbers, not their names. The whole process was designed to be pretty degrading and pretty similar to what the prison experience was at the time. The guards were also given uniforms to wear, and they were not formally trained as guards. They were allowed within certain limits to do whatever they felt necessary to maintain the respect of the prisoners and keep order in the prison. They were warned about the dangers of the job and told that these people were dangerous and that they were to be on guard and to protect themselves just like real officers are as they're going into a prison. Now, the prisoners were all in the jail 24 hours a day. Guards were on 8-hour shifts, and they determined together a shared method for running the prison. So very quickly, they begin to exert control over the prisoners, doing counts, waking them up in the middle of the night, making them do push-ups for things, and really kind of, just doing things to antagonize them and to exert their dominance in the scenario. Nobody really seemed to be taking it overly seriously at the start. The guards, like I said, were requiring things like push-ups for infractions, and the psychological experts who were creating the study said that they were confused because that really didn't seem like a very harsh punishment. And the first day passed without a whole lot of incident. But on the second day, everything changed. The prisoners on their own removed parts of their mandatory uniform, ripped off their numbers, barricaded themselves into cells. They had an all-out, it wasn't a full riot, but just an insurgence on their hands in this fake prison on the second morning. And from that point, things began to escalate in a way that nobody really expected. There were prisoner mental and emotional breakdowns. There were multiple points of groups of prisoners trying to push back and gain control in the prison. They actually did things in the prison that were very normal. On day four, they allowed visits from family members and scheduled other visits for later on, but they ran them through the same types of processes. And there's a lot to be read about how the family members entered and how they did things. People requested attorneys and priest consultations, and a couple of prisoners ended up being released due to these types of breakdowns. At one point, one of the released prisoners, a rumor started that he was not actually in the distress that he was in, but that he faked it so they would release him so that he could come back and break everybody else out of prison. Now, we'll pause and remember, this is a fake prison. They weren't in a real prison or a real situation, but everyone treated this prison break like it was a huge issue, and they were very concerned about the security of the prison. And this included, Zimbardo talks about himself really identifying more as a prison superintendent than a researcher at that point, because he was very concerned about what would happen. And they spent a lot of time on these elaborate plans to keep the prison from being compromised. Prisoners began to refer to themselves by their numbers instead of their names. They didn't forget to do that. Parents actually sent attorneys to meet with their college-age sons. They called and wanted attorneys to meet with them. The attorneys came in and met with them and were giving people real legal advice. Multiple rebellions, enhanced sadistic behaviors by guards when they thought that nobody was watching them, and extreme psychological distress and symptoms from prisoners heightened. It was insane. And I know what you're all probably thinking right now. All of this in 2 weeks? No, not in 2 weeks. It got so bad that Zimbardo actually had to shut down the study after 6 days. That happened when they brought in a recent PhD graduate who'd completed her doctorate, and they wanted her to come in and conduct some interviews as an outsider for the data for the study. And when she was interviewing the prisoners, she called Zimbardo out and said they were treating these boys so terribly and it had to be stopped, that what was going on was not okay. Zimbardo said out of more than 50 outsiders who were engaged with that process, she was the only one who ever questioned the morality of the study. Now, I almost didn't cover this study because it takes a while to unpack, and there's so much more to it. It's fascinating if this type of thing interests you to go back and watch some of the videos, to watch the interviews, a lot of debrief videos on it. But there are really important lessons to be learned that certainly relate to how we act, interact, and teach our children. One, we have to remember that established systems and processes, especially when they're connected to powerful people or powerful things, blind us in a lot of ways. And they are very, very powerful. When a system has a way of doing things or is established, and that system perpetuates itself, people run portions of it, but not the whole. And everyone tends to lose sight of the whole process a lot of times. And so it can create situations where people are complying with and doing things that are destructive and are hurtful or harmful to other people, but not really fully processing that because they're only a small part of the system. With this particular study, again, that had to be ended after 6 days because they had had to eject multiple prisoners for extreme psychological and emotional distress, significant depression, sadistic behavior in people who were not that way before. You have to remember that there was no deception. No one thought this was a real prison. No one was suggested that they should treat it like a full real prison for people coming in from the outside, except that they had to follow the rules. Before the fake arrests, all 24 of these young men consented to this study and volunteered with no coercion to undergo the evaluations and participate. And they signed agreements saying that they understood that if they were assigned as a prisoner, they would be fed a minimal diet, they would have their rights and privacies violated, and undergo harassment just like a real prison. All of them agreed. All of the people, including the parents, attorneys, priests, etc., were told and fully understood this was not a real prison system, but an experiment. and yet everyone acted within the expectations as though it was, even though they knew it wasn't. Awareness of this study reminds us of the humanity of everyone, and that we really aren't as good as we think we are, and that people who are normal and are good and genuinely want good are capable of a lot of really terrible things if the right situations are in place. Our ability to become complicit in unhealthy behaviors without realizing it is a true reality. Even if we're in charge, that can be the case. Zimbardo actually talks a good bit in realizing in retrospect that when he was sitting in the prison at a time where he wasn't supposed to be there, and he was waiting on this rumored insurgents and break-in to bust the other prisoners out, he was functioning as that prison superintendent, not as a primary researching psychologist. He actually called and tried to get the local police department to allow him to transport their 9 prisoners to the unused area of the jail in the local area, and they would not due to liability issues. And he was angry at them for not caring more about the security and safety of their prison. And in retrospect, I was so in this role also, I took it on with them and couldn't see it from an outside perspective either. Again, a really important reminder, none of these people were, quote, messed up. We have this idea that when horrible things happen and when people do very terrible things, that it is only the result, or it is primarily the result of something inside of them that does not exist in everyone. The truth is that these were normal, educated young men. They were not people who had CD pass or issues or other types of things. They were not on any type of scales flagging for psychological problems or distress. They would have been capable of doing anything and would never have been checked for other issues as a result of their current status. Here's the most fascinating thing, is it wasn't just the participants. On that fourth day during a visit, several parents were really upset about kind of how down their kids looked and how much it looked like it was taking from them. One woman and her husband approached Zimbardo because she was upset that her son looked so bad. So she asked several questions and told Zimbardo about how concerned she was. And Zimbardo turned it around on her and asked her, you know, well, yeah, he looks tired because he's not really sleeping. What, does your son not sleep well? Like, is he just not somebody who regularly sleeps well? And it threw her off a bit. And so then he turned to the dad and said, don't you think your boy can handle this? And the father agreed and said, absolutely. He's a leader. He's a good kid. He can handle this. And then he told his wife, we don't need to waste any more of his time. We'll see him at the next visit. And they left. And so those parents who were not actively 24/7 engaged in this system and process also complied with the system. Not just the prisoners who were there 24 hours a day, not just the guards who were there only 8 hours a day. The other 16 hours, they were not at the prison and not actively engaging in this. However, that was another piece that Zimbardo said, a lot of them started taking extra shifts and they didn't ask about being paid more. They really kind of took this on as their role. The last part was that professionals engaged with this as though it was real, even after being told that it wasn't. The attorneys, the priest, the other people who were engaged came in and functioned in the same way that they would in a similar system, as though it were real. We can learn so much about this, one, just in our mentalities about what people are capable of. We have to teach our kids that we're all likely, given the right circumstances, to do wrong, and that it has to be an active process of being considerate, concerned, and intentional about treating others well and making sure that in situations where things seem to be normal, that we're still checking to make sure that what's being done is right, that things that are being permitted. And just because we may even have the right to do some things doesn't make it right all the time. we have to avoid setting up unrealistic expectations that our kids or that we or people we love and care about can't be capable of any certain type of actions. We don't set those up for ourselves, for our kids, but we also don't set it up for pressure for them. Our kids are going to make mistakes. Our kids are going to do things that shock us at times and that surprise us that they're capable of doing. They're going to do things they've never done before, say things that they've never said before. And if you get feedback from another parent or another adult, like teachers or other people at schools, about your kids engaging in ways that are hurtful to others, you obviously want to take everything and use wisdom in how you address it and discuss it, but don't take on the mindset that if someone accuses your kid of something, it has to be a misunderstanding, that there must be some reasonable way or reasonable explanation as to why your kid would be doing that, or people have just misunderstood it altogether. All of our kids are just as capable of these types of behaviors as we and all of the people in this experiment were. I also highly encourage parents to never chalk up poor behavior to just being a kid. While overemphasizing wrongdoing is harmful at any age that a child can behave in inappropriate ways, they need to be disciplined, walked through what is right and how to do right in those situations. To excuse or permit the behavior is oftentimes to create a system that communicates to that kid that that is a just fine way to act if it gets them what they want, which is typically why kids are doing bad behavior anyway. It's getting them something that they want. And when we excuse it or do not hold our kids accountable for it, the message is sent that you and your status and situation are permitted to do that if you decide that that is appropriate and needs to happen in this setting. And you have to speak very clearly to your kids about how you expect them to interact towards others. Both preventatively and when something was done wrong, we have to walk our kids through situations when they've treated people poorly and explain why and help them understand what to do differently. And in the same way, we have to watch our own actions and engagement, because our permissiveness of ourselves also shows them what is permissive of adults. I hope you have enjoyed this particular experiment, because I could nerd out reading about this one for hours. And every time I read about it and dive back into it, I learn more things and am just fascinated all over again. We have one more research experiment to cover in this series, and then we will move on to something else. But I hope you've enjoyed it, and tune in for the next and final episode in this series. Thank you so much for listening to Remodel Parenting. If you know someone who could benefit from this episode, I hope you'll share it with them. And if you love what we're doing, like and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you have topics you'd like to hear about, email us at info@theremodelproject.com.